Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We are baking this week here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, and you're going to want to follow along as we make a Victorian sponge cake, Mary Berry's Victorian sponge cake, when we talk and bake with pastry chef Suzanne Greer, culinary arts instructor at the J. Everett Light Career Center at North Central High School in Indianapolis, and the new president of the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation. We'll be talking about Suzanne's work with the American Culinary Federation and how the organization is changing, and about teaching high school students at the J. Everett Light Career Center, where students run a cafe that's open to the public. And we'll be baking Mary Berry's Victorian sponge cake from the Great British Baking Show, Suzanne's favorite cooking competition show, and mine too. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When we hear about chefs in today's TV and media-focused world, we often imagine the high-profile restaurant chef, a male chef, and often of that high-drama TV temperament. But that's not necessarily the reality. Indianapolis pastry chef Suzanne Greer is the president of the local chapter of the American Culinary Federation. She's also an educator, formerly with Ivy Tech Community College and now at the J. Everett Light Career Center in Indianapolis. And she's working to change the perception of the American Culinary Federation and to change the culture of the industry.
American Culinary Federation is a national organization throughout the United States that is an organization of professional chefs. They have various tiers of certification, which you have to have continuing education, take exams, practicals. But here locally, we're primarily educators, a lot of club chefs, a lot of healthcare chefs, educational chefs. We don't have a whole lot of restaurant chefs, but you know, we're all about networking, education, certification, and fostering and mentoring the young people in the industry. And what I have found is even local industry professionals are wanting to get certified, because anyone can walk out at their door and say, I'm a chef. Just like I would tell my students, when you're done with culinary school, you're not a chef. You're just a glorified line cook.
So the culinary certifications help in the career and as far as the profession, the sort of food profession.
We're trying to elevate the industry. And that was the original cause of developing the ACF, is so when people would look at chefs and cooks and bakers and pastry chefs, that we weren't domestic help, that we were actually professionals with vast knowledge and expertise. Now that ends up focusing on my next thing is, well, it ended up very male-dominated field in a very male-dominated organization. When I started in the ACF, maybe close to 15 years ago, I tend to be like a token female in a lot of scenarios. And as I've progressed, that has changed.
Now, are you seeing some change? Because I have noticed that issue in attending some meetings or some events or media sorts of things with the American Culinary Federation, overwhelmingly male. But that doesn't really now reflect the reality of the food industry, does it?
No, it doesn't. I've been a chef educator for over 6 years, and in my classrooms, it's about 50 to 75% female. But I remember days when I was an executive chef and I was the only female of an all-male staff. So you become bullheaded and you understand that this is the reality you exist in. I've moved around a lot throughout this country, and being a member of the ACF has opened the door for me every time I move someplace. It's given me jobs and opportunities. That's why I drink the water. Now, people have their opinions and they're entitled to them, but I always say you're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution.
So as a member of the ACF, you've held roles, leadership roles in it, and you were recently elected president of the Indianapolis chapter. Now, that is a big thing, especially if you're focused on changing the organization.
I think the biggest issue we have, particularly in Indianapolis and even throughout the United States, is a perception of we're a bunch of old men that sit around and give each other awards and pat each other on the back. And the big thing nationwide is be the change. That's the big thing that ACF is pushing. I've been on an executive board with them on the national level called the Women's Task Force. And it wasn't really all about women empowering. It was more like, we need to move forward or we're going to be extinct. And these are the key points that we need to do to make that change. And I would like them to be more reflective here on the local level, because we embrace everybody. You can just enjoy food. You could be a meeting planner. You could be a manager. Anybody can come to our meetings and learn something new. And that's what it's really our meetings are about, is continuing education. Because as you know, once you stop learning in this business, you might as well retire to stop.
Oh, absolutely, because things are moving so fast and so much is going on. I mean, it's a great time to be in the food industry as far as, you know, interest and excitement and what's going on. But yeah, you've got to stay involved.
And staying current. You know, it's very fascinating. You can look at chefs' portfolios and you can see where they've stopped. Oh, you're stuck in the 90s. Okay, maybe we need to leave the parsley alone, or putting powdered sugar all over the plate, or doing the little heart and really tall food. And you know, there's, what is the next step? What's the next thing? And, you know, we have some neat meetings coming up. We're having a meeting with Indiana Grown. Ben Hardy from the gallery, he's an ACF certified pastry chef, and he wants to host a meeting at his place, the Gallery Pastry Shop, which is gorgeous. And that's the key thing, is constantly opening up new doors for us. What's the next thing? What can we learn more about? How can we network? Because those of us who are educators, we have students that we want to get in the doors of certain establishments, because that's going to help them grow.
Now, what kind of an industry is it today for women, for young women coming into the business? Are there, you know, opportunities? Is the culture changing from what you mentioned, you know, a bunch of old guys sitting around?
The culture is changing, but you have to make it change. When I moved here close to 6 years ago from Dayton, Ohio, I remember walking to my first chapter meeting and being the token female, and there's these female professional, I should say, because there was a lot of female students there, and they bombarded me, "Chef, I'm experiencing this at work. This is happening to me at work." This, they didn't feel comfortable, because what does the male perspective on that? So I was happy to be that mentor. I'm a nurturer. I love helping people in that way. So what I see where the industry is going is brighter and better. But I feel like we're given more of a voice because of the Me Too movement. Not everything has happened to females in that way. But, you know, even just recently I've had comments from young people, from older people, males in particular, that I'm like, that's not appropriate. What makes you think that's okay? That's not professional. Would you say that to another male? And they become surprised or shocked, and they're like, "Really?" I'm like, "No, that's not cool." Or
so you are seeing an awareness of that things do need to change. You know, and the very high profile chefs that we've seen, you know, with harassment issues, that sort of thing. So that's making a difference.
I think it's giving people a voice to say, this is not okay. But also, it makes me reflect on those male chefs that have been in my life, that have treated me with respect, treated me with dignity, that I still call my mentors. I still call them when I'm having an issue or frustration, and they've given me nothing but support. It's something, as an educator, I want to be reflective who I send where to be mentored by. If it's a male, I want them to be a person that I believe is a professional, someone that's respectable, someone that's going to teach the proper techniques, but just the proper ways of how to be a decent human being.
We've been talking today with Suzanne Greer, president of the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation. We'll be right back with more from Suzanne here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are talking today about culinary education with pastry chef Suzanne Greer, an instructor at the J. Everett Light Career Center in Indianapolis. She's focused on teaching the next generation of chefs, high school students who train in a commercial kitchen, who bake pastries, and who run a restaurant called the Light Cafe right there at the center. So we're not talking about home ec classes here. Suzanne tells us about her work at the J. Everett Light Career Center and how she's preparing students for careers in the food biz. So tell me a little bit about your work here at the J. Everett Light Center.
So 2 weeks after moving to Indy, and thanks to the ACF, I ended up working the NFL honors, and I did all the pastries for that. And that opened up doors to be an adjunct faculty member at Ivy Tech, which I was there for about 5 years in baking and pastry arts. And then this summer, out of the blue, I got a call from Chef Brad Narrett, who is the other instructor here at J. Everett Light, wanting me to become an educator with him. So I started July, and I love it. It's really exciting. It's giving young people a true opportunity of what it's like to work in a working, functional kitchen.
Well, now, in case people don't know what it is, tell me a little bit about the J. Everett Light Center and about the cafe that's actually here that's open to the public.
So we are one of, I believe it's roughly 7 or 8 CTE, Career Technology Educating Centers here throughout Indianapolis. And we offer a variety of programs, culinary arts, obviously, dental careers, automotive, cosmetology, EMT, law enforcement.
This is for high school students, right?
For high school students. And we draw from all over the northern part of Indianapolis. So our students can either do 1 or 2 years. If they do 2 years, they can get dual credit from Ivy Tech or Vincennes, which really cuts down the price of an education.
So this is, people bemoan the loss of technical training in high schools, but it is alive and well if you know where to look, perhaps.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't realize we exist or how we exist or what we do. I teach culinary arts. I also teach baking pastry arts. And we have a live open cafe that's open on Wednesdays and Thursdays. You'll have to check our website because it changes, called Light Cafe. And we serve lunch and we serve breakfast and we do pastries and all kinds of things. That it's all student made.
All students are making the pastries and serving and that's running the restaurant?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have about 80 students that go through our doors every day. We have a wide variety of students, from your student that might have physical challenges. Some people might have some academic challenges. Anything, we allow them to realize they have a purpose, they have a voice. I wasn't a great student myself, and it was this culinary world, this, tribe that I call my own, that made me feel like I had a purpose. And that's, being in this industry, you realize those alternative learners, that's where we thrive in this business.
So the students can come through this program or programs like this and graduate out of it ready to go into the workforce, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Workforce readiness is one of our key focus.
So now do you have a lot of your students actually go on into culinary careers?
Absolutely. Many of our students are currently working in culinary careers, which I love to see that because when they are currently working at various establishments throughout the city, you can tell the way they work the line, the way they jump in, the way they do different things. They know how to walk the kitchen. They know the beat of the kitchen, the flow, the energy. And then some people want to get in that energy, but they have to learn. You know, it's baby steps.
Well, now, how do you teach that? How do you get students ready to go out there and cook on a line in a restaurant or to work in front of the house? You know, how do you do that? What's the curriculum?
So we work through various curriculums. We do a Foundations 1 and Foundations 2. They do a circuit. So every student ends up serving front of the house. Every student ends up washing dishes. They end up doing laundry, doing bakery, doing expo, cold prep, garmage. They work various parts of the line, so they get the full exposure of what it's like to do each job. Now, some say, this is not for me. I'm going to go down to dental hygiene, or I'm just in here to eat. Well, that's okay too, but you know, you're going to learn something whether you like it or not.
I'm sure you're teaching them what it really is like.
Absolutely. Sometimes they think I'm too hard on them. I'm like, you need to check in your feelings at the door. But this is the reality. The biggest frustration for me is my students don't understand speed. Accuracy and speed. And I had one student do a little stage, a little internship with Cindy Hawkins down at Circle City Suites. He really loves bread. And he's like, wow, chef, you were serious. I do need to be faster. I'm like, yes, yes, you do. This is a reality. There's a time. Time is money. You need to move, move, move. I think what a lot of people view CTE centers like J. Everett Light and throughout the city is we don't get the best students. No, we have some amazing students that end up going to Johnson & Wales on full rides. I have one student in particular, actually two, and they're outstanding, and I'm really happy because they're first-year students. So they're competing in Skills USA and ProStart, which gives them scholarship opportunities. And I know they're going to go far and do very, very well in this profession and go to very, very good schools. And these students are, you know, have 3.5s and above.
Where do you see culinary education going? So you've worked at Ivy Tech here in Indianapolis, and you're now with the J. Everett Light Center teaching high school students. Are you optimistic about the next generation of culinarians that are coming through your classrooms?
I am. I'm lucky to be at a center that we have such a supporting team. Our director, Sean Wright Browner, she just really supports our program and the tools. She allows us to have the tools just for us to succeed. And what our students get to experience day in and day out, and the hands-on training is fantastic. I was shocked when I walked into this program going from Ivy Tech to here. There's no bumps. It's just smooth sailing. And when they go, even when I was teaching Ivy Tech, when I would get students from centers like this, they were far and above. And I can just only see where we're growing because we need more workforce readiness, right? Everyone says, mm-hmm. I need people in my kitchen. But I want chefs in the community to also partner up with us so we can create some type of, you go work for this chef, tell me how it is, then maybe like roads to full-time employment. Creating partnerships like that to get real world experience, you can't teach that in the classroom.
We've been talking with pastry chef Suzanne Greer, culinary instructor at the J. Everett Light Career Center. We'll be right back with more from Suzanne when we head into the kitchen to bake a recipe from the Great British Baking Show here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, ready to head into the kitchen with pastry chef Suzanne Greer, an instructor at the J. Everett Light Career Center and the president of the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation, and she's a fan of the Great British Baking Show. So I had to take the opportunity to ask some questions. For example, I wanted to know about some of those recipes the contestants have to bake that say to start with a sponge. Now, just what is that? Well, we're going to find out as Suzanne walks us through making Mary Berry's classic Victorian sponge cake. So we hear a lot about competition shows on TV. Everyone has watched all the Food Network shows, and especially some of the pastry shows. So your specialty is baking and pastry. And, you know, I have to ask about the Great British Baking Show. It's one of my favorites.
The only show worth watching, in my opinion. The civilized baking competition show.
I love that. It is civilized. And yes, it is a competition, but they seem to have time to make their creations. They all seem to have really been working hard and practicing. But I'm always wondering about all their knowledge and all the things that they bake that I don't really know exactly what they are. So I find myself Googling things as I'm watching it.
Me too. 20 plus years in the business, and I'm like, what's a princess? Swedish princess cake? What's this? And then I get excited. It makes me want to go and try. And that's the biggest thing, is every country has their own thing.
But they all seem to know exactly what a drizzle cake is, and I'm there trying to figure out now, I wonder exactly what that might be. Like, what is it that I would call it? You know, because they all know all of these names and specific cakes. So, but they're always talking about first make a sponge, you know, a sponge, make a simple sponge. And a friend of mine asked me recently, you know, is that just a cake? Are they just baking a cake? What is a sponge? So now I want to ask you, and here we are in the kitchen at the J. Everett Light Center, and I think you're going to tell me what this is.
Well, it depends what kind of sponge.
Of course it does, right?
Because what Mary Berry uses is a Victorian sponge, okay, which is slightly different. She does an all-in-one dump method. Now, American cakes are pretty different. They tend to be sweeter, denser, fattier. The American quote-unquote style cake is like a pound cake. It's high in fat, has more of a fine structure, and it's very, very moist. And it's interesting, the difference between a box cake mix and a scratch cake, and most people will say the scratch is drier than the box. But then there's also the high ratio cakes that most bakeries use.
Now, what is that?
So a high ratio is a cake that primarily uses a shortening, an emulsified shortening, and it has a two-stage method to it. So it has, once again, it goes more pound cakey, thicker, denser, more structure. But if you overmix, which I find a lot of students end up overmixing, you have a weaker crumb, and then it will fall apart. So then we have our foam cakes.
Okay, now see another phrase that I might not know.
Which is like your chiffon or your angel food cake. Now, chiffon has a little bit of fat in it. When you prepare that pan, you don't spray the sides, because it has to climb up the sides. Now, the angel food, you don't spray it at all. You don't want any fat. And it will climb up the sides, and it'll be nice and buoyant. But also, there's a Genoise cake.
That's right. That's another one that I hear all the time.
Now, Genoise tends to be very European, and a lot of Americans don't like Genoise. In a lot of places I've worked, when the Europeans come, it's interesting what they like, which tends to be less sweet and more of the almond pastes and the hazelnuts and those kinds of flavors, you know, marmalades and figs and
all very Mary Berry sorts of things.
Yes, and my kind of things too. But Americans, they like, and of course I'm generalizing, more sweet, and especially when I used to decorate cakes, oh, the more drag queenish and garish, those sold like crazy. But you do something more civilized and tame, that would sit and never sell.
So tell me what we're going to prepare today, because you have the ingredients all spread out, mm-hmm, and we have a recipe. So tell me what that is.
So we're doing Mary Berry's Victorian sponge.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I'm very excited about this.
So I have all my ingredients. One thing I like to teach is have all your ingredients at the same temperature. Various temperatures can have different fluctuations in baking. Baking's very temperamental. So I have my butter, just standard butter, nothing fancy about it, unsalted. That's the only thing fancy in my bowl. I have this all in grams now. Technically, grams are more technical than ounces. It's more exact. And I have my sugar. And the way Mary does it, she dumps it all in there. So I'm trying to resist mixing.
Okay.
So I made my own self-rising flour, but you can purchase it in the store, which I would recommend, versus making your own. It has multiple uses besides this fantastic cake. And 4 eggs at room temperature.
Okay, so you put this all into the bowl of a stand mixer?
Yes. And I have found some people want to put a whip attachment, and you don't want the whip. It will incorporate too much air. You want the paddle attachment.
Oh, no, that's very interesting. I was just watching a show, honestly, just last night, and some of the judges said, they're using the whip attachment. They should use the paddle. I mean, seriously, last night.
So resist on putting it on what I call hyperactive. There's many people that just want to turn it all the way to number 10.
So this is just on the stir setting, the very low end of the setting.
And we're just stirring it till it's all incorporated, because it's very important not to overmix, because then you're going to ruin your crumb.
Well, the crumb is very important.
Yes, yes it is. And I always stop, and this is a mistake that I see many new bakers do, they don't scrape the bowl. Because a lot of your ingredients can get stuck at the bottom and don't fully incorporate. So I always scrape the paddle. As I teach my students, everything in here is money.
Right.
Right? Food costs. So I just kind of hand mix everything till it's all scraped up. And then I'm going to put it on a couple turns. Not too much. Perfect. All incorporated. So I always say this is homogeneous, meaning when you look at this, you can't tell the difference between the butter, the eggs, the flour, and the sugar.
We're in the kitchen today with pastry chef Suzanne Greer of the J. Everett Light Career Center, baking a classic Victorian sponge cake. We'll be right back and get that cake in the oven here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, baking with pastry chef Suzanne Greer of the J. Everett Light Career Center and the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation. Suzanne has been making a recipe today from the Great British Baking Show for a Victorian sponge cake. She's been mixing the ingredients following Mary Berry's technique and is just about to put the batter in the pans and get those pans in the oven. But first, a few questions. Now, what are you looking for as you're sort of stirring it around?
Well, I don't want to see any streaks of butter, which I don't see that. I don't want to see any, as eggs kind of sit out, they get kind of dry. I don't want to see any clumps. And the next thing I'm going to do is it calls to prepare 2 pans. Now, our pans are a little larger than what it calls for, so our cakes can be a little smaller. And what you will do is you'll take 2 rounds and you'll grease it with butter, not too much butter, just lightly grease, and then you'll put your piece of parchment at the bottom, and then you'll evenly disperse the cake batter into 2 pans. So it's simple cake liner at the bottom. Now, one thing people do, and this is something I always teach, make sure your parchment doesn't go up the cake, up the sides, because when it goes up the sides, it'll dig into the actual cake body, and when you flip it out, it will tear the sides of the cake. And that's when, like when I teach cakes, icings, and fillings, that's when I'm like, oh. So I'm gonna just lightly butter everything up. I like using butter versus a lot of sprays, I know some people get the spray with the flour in there. I just think that's too much. Just use some good old butter. A lot of these canned sprays leave a flavor, and you have to be careful what that flavor might be. It'll give you a very artificial taste. So what I do with my parchment, you're like, how do I butter my parchment? So I take my piece of parchment and I slightly smear it on the bottom, and then I flip it over. So now the bottom is all nicely greased. And you want to make sure you kind of flatten it out so you don't get any major creases that can create cracks into your cake body, because that weakens the structure.
So now this is a two-tier cake, right, that has some sort of filling in the middle?
Yes. So, sorry, Mary, but I did not make the jam. I hear her in Britain yelling at me.
Oh, no, because a lot of times it's like start out by making a jam, you know, that you're going to eventually put in between the layers of your cake.
Because, you know, Jolene, we sit there and make jam every day. I'm going to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Let me make that grape jelly.
So no, you did not make the jam that's going to go in between the cake.
No. So this is a jam that a lot of bakeries use. It's called a baker's jam. And one thing working in healthcare when I did is you learn to respect that certain people can and cannot eat certain things. And seeds are a huge thing for people who have dentures or even diverticulitis. So I always like using seedless jams, so it's more friendly to all. So now I am going to divide the batter into two pans. So it's not a drippy batter, it's more of a pasty batter, if that makes any sense. Just eyeballing equal parts. I mean, I know some bakers get very particular and have to scale everything exact, but I'm just not that person.
So then you'll spread this around in there, because like you said, it's not going to spread itself. It's a very thick batter.
So it's like mashed potatoes. And so you have to go in there and evenly spread it out. So it's equally proportioned around the surface. And like this afternoon, my students were like, "Chef, are you mad?" And I'm like, "No, I'm just banging on my batter." Because what I'll do next is I'm going to take my pan and tap it out. So it becomes more evenly distributed. Now, we have convection ovens. There's conventional and convection. And when you're using convection, you always want to reduce the temperature by 25 degrees. So this will go in at 325 for 20 minutes, and don't you dare open up the oven during that 20-minute period of time.
We've been baking today with pastry chef Suzanne Greer. We'll be right back to see how that Victorian sponge cake comes out here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. So, just what is a sponge cake? The contestants on the Great British Baking Show often have to start out by making a sponge. So since I was talking today with Indianapolis pastry chef Suzanne Greer, it seemed like the perfect time to get some advice from another fan of the popular PBS show. So Suzanne has talked us through mixing and baking a classic Victorian sponge cake today from the Great British Baking Show. And now we are just about to try it. Describe to me the cake that you have made with Mary Berry's recipe.
So this is a Victorian sponge cake, and it's fatty, it's light, it's delicious, but inside all it calls for is jam and buttercream. I have found that sometimes when you do a high art of pastry, people are scared to eat it. They're intimidated by it. But when you do something that is, I want to say, homey, it's more welcoming in some ways, and you feel like it's okay to cut into it. It's okay to eat it. And that's why I like, you know, the Great British Baking Show so much, is it's this more approachable baking.
Well, they are cutting into and eating everything.
Absolutely.
So you're going to do this, right?
Absolutely. And there's art to cutting cake. All right. And I always like using a little bowl of hot water and cleaning my knife, because you make nice clean cuts. I go straight across. I'm not going to make a wonky shape because, you know, us OCD people can't handle those wonky cuts.
So it is cutting beautifully.
Yes. Hopefully nice crumb.
Or Paul Hollywood would ding you on that.
I don't want him coming after me. Although he's quite the silver fox.
Well, that's what they say.
So the first piece is always the most challenging.
Oh, always. Oh, my goodness. So this is beautiful. So tell me about the presentation of the cake and how you put it together.
So essentially, you just take the two layers of cake and you put jam on each side. Now, I've seen in many pictures it's only on one side, but I like it on both. And then you put your buttercream in the middle, and there's different ways to do that. And then you just make it like a sandwich. You smack it all on top. It's so easy because you don't have to ice the outside,
right?
Because it's so moist. Probably one of the easier cakes. A lot of people could do it.
So this is what they're talking about when they're talking about make a sponge. This is what it would come out like.
Yes. Essentially, yes.
So it has a what would they call that? A very tight crumb, or a very dense crumb? Maybe
a tight, fine crumb.
A fine crumb. Now, that's what Mary Berry would say. It has a fine crumb.
When you see large holes, like, for example, you see on top of this cake, it means it's over-mixed.
Okay, so this is the cake box, the mixed cake, and the texture is different.
And you see larger holes because this has been over-mixed. So the over-incorporation of air while it's baking, it wants to get out. So it makes like these little wormholes. So it affects the crumb structure.
So that's what you're trying to avoid.
Yes.
when you want this nice crumb.
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
And, you know, I watched you through this process. It seems like something anybody could do.
Yes, but as I tell a lot of people, I've been doing this for a long time. This is what I do for a living. When I teach cake decorating, they're like, "Chef, that looks so easy." I'm like, "But it's not. It's a skill that has to be built on. You might make this recipe and you're like, why didn't this turn out?" Well, that's when you become a scientist. Usually, good scientists are good bakers. Because it's all a formula, you know.
So you would
a formula.
So you would go back and see what it was, what was the problem? Like, for example, overmixing.
Absolutely. Like my first victim over there of my crumb is I had to make my self-rising flour.
Okay, so you did. So you started out early on with a version of this with a different ratio of baking powder to flour.
Absolutely, because I looked up one site, and it told me 1 cup to 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, and it just didn't turn out right. I wasn't happy. So then I Googled British self-rising flour, and it said 2 teaspoons to 8 ounces of flour. So once I did that, I got a better structure, better ratio, much more content of my results. Now, could it be better? Of course, because, you know, that's pastry chefs. It's never good enough.
Well, it is beautiful, and I'm looking forward to trying it. So I have to tell you about the cake, a Victorian sponge cake recipe from the bbc.co.uk, which is delicious. or as Mary Berry would say, absolutely scrummy. It's a yellow cake with a lovely crumb and a wonderful layer of jam and buttercream. I'm imagining myself enjoying that cake with a nice cup of tea, and I'm thinking that I might even try to make it at home. And that's what I wonder about when I watch the Great British Baking Show. So since I was in the kitchen with a pastry chef, I thought I'd get a little advice. So we have been enjoying Mary Berry's Victorian sponge cake here with Suzanne Greer at the J. Everett Light Career Center here in Indianapolis. Tell me a little bit about if you think this is doable for, you know, for real people, for hobbyists, for people who just bake for fun.
The Victorian sponge? Well, I'm going to reference the recipe here a little bit. I think it's doable for home bakers if you pay attention.
Well, no, that's what they're always telling us. Read the recipe.
Read the recipe. I read it 3 or 4 times. Everything primarily on this recipe is in grams, which is you get more exact measurements in grams than ounces.
So if you have a home scale in your kitchen, you can set it to grams, right?
Absolutely. You'll see some type of function that you'll see a G or OZ, and you just tap that and make sure it has a little G on the screen.
So it is more precise. So it is something that you would recommend people measure in grams.
Absolutely. Okay. And this year, I've been getting my baking students more focused on measurements like that versus cups. So one of the items, first thing is free-range eggs. Well, no, I don't have free-range eggs, so it's okay. The other thing is caster sugar. Well, what is caster sugar?
Well, now that's a good question. So tell me about that.
So in the UK, their granulated sugar is a larger grain. So caster sugar is right between powdered sugar and granulated sugar. Now, some may say American granulated sugar is finer and you can use it. For this cake, I used just our regular granulated sugar. This was not caster sugar, but you can purchase what is called baker's sugar at any grocery store. So self-rising flour that has the addition of baking powder that is formulated in a larger amount. Now at home, I keep a bag because I like using that when I do my biscuits. Here, I don't do that because it's just another staple that we don't need.
So that's why you had to make it yourself.
That's why I had to make it myself, exactly. Unsalted butter, you know, butter, European butters have less air, more fat content, and that's what I like to use when I do like sugar cookies. But when we look at shows, specifically the Great British Bake Off, I get rather excited and want to look up stuff. And one of those crazy cakes I did was the tennis court cake.
I remember that one.
It's so technical and doing this and then the fondant and the marzipan. And a lot of the stuff can be made at home, but it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of research. Just like when I looked into how to make that Swedish princess cake. Because, you know, I have so much free time that I can just bake these things. I'm trying to teach students and I'm sitting here trying to bake this princess cake. But there's a lot of technical skill, and you can do this if you want to do that technical baking.
We're talking and baking today with pastry chef Suzanne Greer of the J. Everett Light Career Center and the American Culinary Federation. Stay with us for more on baking here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We've been baking today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, and pastry chef Suzanne Greer has baked us a classic Victorian sponge cake. You can find the recipe at bbc.co.uk, and she tells us about other types of cakes as well. But for Suzanne, an Italian buttercream icing is what you want to really elevate a cake recipe, even if you're making a boxed mix. So tell me about the different types of cakes. We're in the kitchen at the J. Everett Light Center with pastry chef and instructor Suzanne Greer, making Mary Berry's Victorian sponge cake. But you've also baked off of a couple of other cakes, and we're going to talk a little bit about the differences. So tell me what we're looking at.
So this is called a Genoise. And what you do is you take your egg yolks, your eggs, and your sugar, and you whip it, and then you put it over heat to about 100, 109, and then you put it back on the mixer with a whip attachment, and it whips, and it turns from a dark to a very light color, and you have to get it to ribbon stage. And that's when you take your whip attachment, and you run it across the batter with the batter on there, and you can see the line, and it stays. Okay. And then you you fold in your flour, and you gently put it in, and it creates a... It's been sitting out in the air, right. But you feel how dry it is.
Right. It is. It's very dry. Not your typical moist cake box cake.
Oh, no. This is perfect for putting macerations, a.k.a. simple syrups.
Right.
So I would do, you know, equal parts sugar to water, and I always like adding a little booze, of course. So it could be any type of liqueur you'd like, let's say amaretto, and then you soak this cake body.
I bet it would soak up the whatever you were drizzling over it. I bet.
Absolutely, this is more of a European style cake. This is what when you do a lot of classic desserts and cakes and torts, it calls for this style. So this cake can either be done as like I show you here in a round, or in a sheet pan, and that goes into more of your jelly rolls.
I could see that you could roll that up.
Yes, it's nice, and with those you got to roll it up right when it's out of the oven, because if you wait, it'll crack. And then I also had my students bake off one of our box cake mix. Now, certain pastry chefs shun box cake mix, and I understand their point, but it's also tried and true. And for bakers of the world, pastry chefs of the world, sometimes you are a one-person operation in a large facility, and that's just, you've got to bake bread, make dessert, make pie, do all this stuff. And
so sometimes mixes can come in handy.
Absolutely. And especially when you're a busy parent and you're just trying to do something good for your kid. And this is what most Americans are used to. Nice crumb structure.
Yes, this looks like the picture on the cake box.
Absolutely. It's moist. I still always put a maceration in here. It imparts flavor and texture.
So do you do that every time you even a cake mix cake?
I do. I always like to tort cakes, and torting is when you cut in two different areas of the cake, and you have three layers of cake and two layers of filling. It's an even proportion of cake to filling. That filling could be mousse, it could be buttercream, and I like that ratio, and I just think it ends up making a party in your mouth. Like in the spring when I make my lemon cake, and then I do like strawberries when they're in season, it makes happiness.
And I would imagine that it really elevates a cake mix cake.
It does. And most people can't tell it was from a cake mix because it comes down to the icing. I always use Italian buttercream. I mean, my husband's like, can you stop the mixer? Because it's been going forever. And my students are like, is it ever going to come together when I teach it? But when it comes together, it's this magical moment. And I think it's so much better than standard buttercream.
Well, now tell me what the difference is. Tell me about the buttercream that you like to make.
So Italian buttercream, the reason why it's called Italian buttercream is because we use an Italian meringue, which is a cooked meringue.
Again, this is one of those things that the people on the shows, they know what a cooked meringue is, so tell me what that is.
So there's three kinds of meringues. There's the common meringue, which probably if you've done meringue, it's just your sugar and egg whites whipped together. Then you have a Swiss meringue, and that's when it's the egg whites are slightly cooked in a double boiler to a certain temperature, and then you put that in with the egg whites, and the sugar, and you put it in the mixer. Then you have the Italian meringue, which you bring up to the sugar in the water mixture to 240, and as the egg whites are mixing, you pour in the sugar, the hot boiling sugar, which I fell victim. And if you ever get sugar on you, do not, just let it sit. Don't spread it. So you gently pour that in. You keep it whipping until it cools down to about, I found like 89 is the perfect spot. And then you add your softened butter. And then you go through a panic, like it's not coming together.
This starts to sound like I'm going to be going, oh my gosh, what did I do wrong?
And then all of a sudden, poosh, it's this beautiful sound. And that's when I add a little cream de coco in there. And everything's happy. It's just this beautiful, light, fluffy icing that people love. And it's delicious. Versus a standard American buttercream, which is your powdered sugar, Crisco, any type of shortening. And sometimes you're lucky enough to put butter in it. And you can always tell the shortening-based buttercream is when you get that film in your mouth. You're like,
I'm just imagining that right now. It's like, yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Oh, yes. But I think it's, I have no issues against standard American buttercream, but I like using full butter. I always watch how much sugar, because I think we can put too much sugar into things and it ends up being overly sweet. You need to find that balance of that sweet, savory spot where it's not too much.
We've been talking with pastry chef Suzanne Greer of the J. Everett Light Career Center and president of the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and D Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. We have been baking on the show today, so thanks for tuning in and following along. And thanks also to our guest, pastry chef Suzanne Greer, president of the Indianapolis chapter of the American Culinary Federation, and a culinary arts instructor at the J. Everett Light Career Center in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and D Radio. Eat, Drink, and D Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.